I have two goals for our next however many weeks together, 21 lessons. First, to align our thinking about marriage with Scripture. As much as we may think we've corrected for our culture's misunderstanding of marriage, our instincts are still wrong so much of the time. And that could be because what you think of as marriage is more influenced by your own marriage than the Bible, or by your parents' marriage than the Bible, or what you see on TV than the Bible. And so our job is to listen carefully to Scripture and retrain our instincts and assumptions. So that's the first goal. Second goal would be to see the beauty of marriage. It's beautiful as a reflection of the one who designed it. So as we understand God's design for marriage, you know, whether you're married or, say, I don't know, are there any single people in this class? Probably not. This class is for them too, so I'm going to say comments even though they're not here. That will help you think about maybe something that you could say to them. But whether you're married or single, you can marvel at the wisdom and perfection of God. So my hope is that you emerge from this class, these classes, not just with some how-to tips on marriage, but with a renewed sense of how amazing this God is who calls us as his own. And again, some people who might be in here, not maybe today, but in the future, may not be married. This class is very much meant for them too. I've always said, best time to start learning about marriage is before you get married. And if somebody was single, how would they make use of this time together? Just a few thoughts. Again, consider the marriages of your married friends. This class would help a single person to love them better, understand them better, and pray for them better. Again, to consider your potential future marriage. This class will help shape how you think about dating, what you're looking for in a spouse, and how you can prepare for marriage. And then to consider the beauty of what God has designed. Remember that marriage is a temporary institution. In heaven, God will have something better than marriage for us. And so if the temporary placeholder is beautiful, imagine what God has for us in heaven. And of course, I think everyone here is married. So let me offer a few do's and don'ts for you in this class. Don't let the ideal discourage you. Especially if you've been married for a while, your experience will inevitably fall short of the Bible's ideal. That's disappointing. And it's everyone's experience. But it's not outside of God's control. So while I hope that this class helps you get closer to that ideal, remember that the God who in his infinite wisdom designed the ideal of marriage also in his infinite wisdom decided to withhold some of it from you. And you can trust him with those limits. They are temporary, they are wise, and they are for your good. Don't use this class as leverage in arguments with your spouse. I do not want my name coming up in your fights. As in Matthew, but Matthew said in the class that you should. Okay, absolutely not. Do use this class to examine your purposes for your marriage in light of God's purpose for your marriage. And that will be especially relevant in today's class. Take the scripture passages that we discuss and discuss them more at home as a couple. And do use this class as a mirror to your own attitudes, instincts, assumptions, and struggles in marriage. I hope that the main person you have in mind throughout the class is not your spouse and the things they do or don't do, but you. Okay, so that's all for introduction to the course. Any questions on that kind of overview of where we're headed? All right. Today we're going to be spending our time in Genesis 1 and 2, where God first gives us marriage, and we'll look at God's purpose for marriage, which will lead us to understand how he intends to accomplish that purpose, the power of marriage, which in turn will lead us to what I'm going to call the paradox of marriage, which will set up much of the rest of the course. So if you haven't already, open your Bible to Genesis chapter 1, and I have a lot of these passages in here as well. So first, the purpose of marriage. 10 years and a few weeks ago, Cheryl Perez and I stood across from each other in a church in Winter Haven, Florida, and God called God himself as witness to some massive promises we made to each other as long as we both shall live. And then we were husband and wife. And 10 years in, my marriage is the best part of my life, a testimony to the goodness and mercy of God. So why did we get married? Well, we wanted to stop shuttling back and forth and long-distance calls between Louisville and California, where she was living at the time. And she was gorgeous, and already my best friend. And we wanted to have kids together and do ministry together and grow old together. But there was a deeper purpose in our marriage that we didn't fully comprehend at the time, which, beyond kids and sex and friendship and ministry, has been the greatest reason for the joy in our marriage. And it's the purpose that we get right at the beginning of the Bible. So look with me at Genesis 1:26. We're having made everything else in the universe. God says, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And then he does just that. Verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. He created him, male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So a few things to note here. First, what you see in verse 27 is our purpose statement as human beings. We're made according to God's image, and that's why we exist. We don't exist first and foremost because God needed what we could do for him. He didn't need us to be fruitful and multiply, right? He was filling the earth just fine by himself. No, he made us according to his image. He made us as his representatives to point back to the wonder of who he is. And that's why he made us, like mirrors reflecting his glory. And you might think about this made according to his image bit in two pieces, perceive and portray. Like a mirror takes in light and reflects it out. We perceive. Because we're made in his likeness, we can understand who he is even from our own experience. We can discover the wonder of his creativity through our creativity, the delight of his mercy through our own mercy, and so forth. And we portray. By looking at who we are, someone should understand a very small shadow of the glory of who God is. So perceive and portray, that's our purpose. And then second, when God made man, he made him male and female. So this purpose of perceiving and portraying was for Adam and Eve together. And as we'll see in Genesis 2, some of that was to happen through marriage. And again, if someone's not married, right, you're just as completely made in the image of God as your married friend. There's nothing lacking just because you're not married. We see that in Genesis 9, verse 6. And yet, there's a unique way in which a married couple can perceive and portray God, just as there's a unique way in which someone can serve Christ when they're not married. And then third, God's command in verse 28 to be fruitful and exercise dominion is his blessing. When God blesses in Genesis, right, be it the animals, he blesses the Sabbath, he blesses Noah, and he's explaining how his purposes will be accomplished. And this is no exception. Right? So the purpose, made in God's image, we then work that out in verse 28 through our love and our labor, through our relationships and our rule. Work, family, these things matter, not primarily because God needs us to do it. Remember, he's quite productive all by himself and highly relational within the Trinity. But because that's how we reflect him as those made in his image. It's so easy to value a marriage based on what it produces. What it produces for myself, my happiness and companionship. What it produces for others, children, stability, a foundation for ministry and community. And those things are all true, but the deeper purpose for marriage has God at its very heart. The deeper purpose for marriage is that it's a key way in which we perceive the glory of who God is and then portray that glory to ourselves and others. Let me pause there. Any comments or questions so far on that? Before we go on to Genesis 2.
Sean. So it was not good for man to be alone. How do we reconcile that with Paul saying it's okay to be single? I'm not arguing that everyone should be married, but it's almost like singleness later on became just the effect of the fall. Well, maybe, I don't know, I don't understand that. But is it good that every man not be alone? Or?
That's a great question. Yeah. We're going to deal with that in lesson 20. So, I have many things to tell you, but you cannot bear them right now.
You wrote them all down.
We're going to get there.
Matthew.
Yes.
This all is so familiar to us, but in our culture today, marriage is not, it's becoming less the norm. More and more people are choosing to wait to get married until their 30s and put off having children, and it's a real problem in our society now. Mm-hmm. And we're living together and not getting married. Mm-hmm. And there was a time when this was just all accepted and this is the norm, and today it's not so much.
Mm-hmm. I don't mean to contradict you, but it's happening in the church just as prevalently as it is outside the church.
Yeah.
That's the sad part. Maybe not this church.
What is happening?
That reflection of marriage, the worldly reflection.
Oh, it is happening.
Yeah.
Well, among us right here, not so much.
Maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Good. I said I didn't mean to poo-poo on your question.
I'll wait patiently.
Yeah. We'll get to it in 5 months.
when you've forgotten what your question was.
Some of it will come through.
As we talk. The singleness class would be a good time to do that.
We'll get there. So, we see this receiving and portraying of the glory of God. As we continue on in the Genesis 2, verse 18, here's maybe a hint at what you're getting at. Verse 18, where God says, "It is not good that the man, it is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper corresponding to it, or fit for him." Now, again, from our modern Western perspective, it's easy for us to read that to say that the problem was that Adam was lonely. And that doesn't quite do full justice to the text. The problem was that Adam was alone, not necessarily lonely. Right? By himself, he couldn't do all that God commanded him to do, which is to be fruitful, exercise dominion. By himself, he couldn't live out what it means to be made in the image of God. And this is, in fact, what the Apostle Paul picks up on in his famous teaching on marriage in Ephesians 5, as he describes a husband loving his wife as Christ loved the church, and the wife submitting to her husband as the church submits to Christ. He says in verse 32, "This mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church." It's not that Paul stumbled upon marriage as a convenient analogy of Christ's love for his bride, the church. No, he looks deep into the very beginning of all things and sees there that marriage was built to be an analogy, designed to be an analogy. In marriage, we perceive in new ways the glories of God's love for us, and then we live it out, portraying who God is, the glory of who he is. Now, the problem is how theoretical and impractical this sounds at first glance, right? Okay, Matthew, I know that marriage is a picture of Christ and the church. That's very nice and all. Now, can we get back to how I can have a happy marriage? And I get that. And one way we can make this more practical is by understanding who the audience is. That is, if a marriage is a portrayal of Christ's love for his church, who's watching? A few people. First, you. This dramatic acting out of Christ's love in marriage is intended first and foremost for you, the married person. You learn the joy of self-sacrificial love, which helps you understand the joy Christ has in loving you. In marriage, you walk in God's footsteps like a little kid at the beach, jumping from one of his dad's footprints to the next. And we discover, through our own experience, God's delight in being God as we imitate him. Second audience member is your spouse, and that follows pretty closely. If I lead my wife well, she will find it easier to follow Christ. If I love her well, she will better understand the love of Christ. Third, your kids, if you have them. A marriage will profoundly shape the children's deepest, most sincere theology, their base level understanding of Jesus, for better or for worse. Fourth, to God, who delights in being discovered for how delightful he really is. And then finally, those around you. They may not be able to articulate the labels Christ and the church, but your marriage should look distinctive to them, because it is responding to, reflecting the supernatural love of God. It is, in some way, either faithful or unfaithful, a picture or portrayal of him, either accurately or distorted. So, if happiness or companionship or children or ministry are at the heart of your purpose statement for marriage, all good things, but if that's at the center, then God is not at the center of your marriage. He may be involved, and you may well be seeking to follow him in your marriage, but he's not the center, the heart. So, instead, we must understand that marriage is about knowing God, perceiving who he is, and it's about responding to the goodness we find in him, reflecting that goodness to ourselves and to the world as we portray him. That's the source of all value in marriage, of its lasting beauty and its greatest joy and satisfaction. The closeness of marriage can make you wonderfully happy, but if happiness is your driving motivation for marriage, you will look at your spouse one day and deep down inside think, is this it? The ability to raise children together is one of the amazing privileges of marriage, but if that is your driving motivation, then one day they'll leave and you'll think to yourself, is this it? There's a line from a wedding sermon that I still remember, which gives me hope when I, Lord willing, one day preach a wedding sermon. And that's, you can only love your spouse well if you love God more than your spouse. The driving force behind your marriage should be to know God and respond to him. And you need this perspective when you encounter your spouse's sin and your own, especially when it's not honeymoon sin, but 7 years in. Right, he'll probably always struggle with this sin, kind of sin. And his sin won't make you happy. But through it, you can still perceive truth about God and portray his response to our sin. And that's what gives us hope. You need this perspective when you need to forgive. And forgiveness is so unfair. It'd honestly be better, you might say, to just to walk away from the marriage. But no, instead, you forgive because that's how you portray the forgiveness you've received in Christ. You need this perspective when you're 10 years in and you realize that this marriage will not be what you hoped for on your wedding day. It's fine. It's not great, maybe. And as a pastor, I still want to tell you, don't worry, there's hope. Just listen carefully to what we have to share in this class and things will be great. But that's not always true. And yet, if we look at this deeper purpose for marriage, the joy that comes from perceiving and portraying the goodness of God, I can say all those things and more. Right. From that perspective, your experience of marriage can be great, wildly successful, even if it's not what you envisioned on your wedding day. So this purpose statement for marriage means that marriage isn't fundamentally about what it produces, like happiness and children, but what it shows about God, mainly to the two of you. Let me give two quick examples of how this changes the way marriage operates, and then finish this little section. Let's say you've got a hard decision to make. If marriage were about accomplishment, success would be about getting to the right answer. But you can do that in a way that gives your wife deep misgivings about trusting your leadership which makes it harder for her to trust the God who put you in leadership. Instead, success is leading your wife through this difficult process in a way that helps her trust Christ. Your leadership portrays the Good Shepherd, and then she perceives in a new way the delight she has in following him. Or let's say that you're having, here's one for the ladies, let's say you're having an argument with your husband. You know how this goes. If you yell at him and let him have it, you prolong the fight a little, but boy, will it feel good to put him in his place, and it won't be long before he forgives you and things will be all lovey-dovey again. If marriage were about happiness, you might pursue that route, and it might even work out for you. But your treatment of your husband is your treatment of Christ. And so you humble yourself and confess your sin rather than railing on his. Okay, so there is a purpose for marriage that's deeper than happiness, deeper than children, deeper than ministry together. It is to perceive and portray the glory of the goodness of God. Any questions so far or comments on that theme?
It's powerful. I mean, that so often people want to get out of their marriages and they don't think about this at all. They don't ever, I'm not sure I thought of it that way, but they're not happy, they're not having kids, they're not, their kids are a mess, their husband's a mess, their wife's a mess. A lot of good reasons to get out, but never, it's never about God in those arguments usually. It's not that simple. I mean, we've talked to other people with problems. I don't mean to be curt about how these problems can just destroy your thinking, your happiness, and you want out. But if God's the purpose in this marriage, that should be strong motivation, at least to try to resolve these problems. And even if they can't be resolved, to endure and be content. But
Great. Perceive the glory of God and portray the glory of God. I was thinking, like, the worst example is that. It does that. And that was, its purpose was Hosea and Gomer. Yeah. To show other people what God's love is like.
Yeah. In the midst of great difficulty.
Yeah.
In trial. Yeah. Other comments? Or questions? Joe.
Focus on the ultimate purpose removes any sense of complacency in the current state of the marriage, any sense of doing all right and coasting, and it reemphasizes the need to continually press forward.
Yeah. Something about purposes or ultimate goals that are motivations, aren't they? You don't know where you're headed or why you're headed there. It's hard to stay motivated to keep going. That's true in just about any arena. Athletes compete to win the prize, Rick. Musicians practice to learn proficiency for their performance, right? And marriage is the same way. If you have the ultimate purpose and goal in mind, that will motivate you to perceive and portray, even in great difficulty. Let's move on. That's the longest point. So I know we have about 20 minutes. We'll take the next two together. And the purpose of marriage is to perceive and portray. How does that happen? That leads to the next point there in your workbook. The power of marriage. In Genesis 2:18, as we already read, God says he will make a helper corresponding to him or fit for the man. So in verse 21 of that chapter, he creates Eve out of Adam, and Eve then is fit for Adam. Or more literally, she is opposite him or corresponding to him. So the purpose of a marriage is to perceive and to portray, but the man and the woman will not go about doing this in identical fashion, because from the very beginning, they were created to be different from each other. And the power of marriage is found in those differences. And it's through those differences that we can have children, enjoy sex, have a kind of companionship that's different in kind from any other friendship. It's through those differences that we'll learn about God and show who he is, as we see in Ephesians 5. And so these differences then aren't so much roles, although we'll talk about that, as they are orientation. Not something you turn on and off, like, okay, looks like we're at an impasse, time to turn on my husbandly leadership role. But as we'll discuss later, this is what defines the basic shape of your marriage. And those differences are the whole point, right? That's the power of our marriage. And yet early in marriage, every married person will at some point think something like, if you would just approach this like I do, this would be so much easier. Or if you could just feel what I'm feeling, this would be so much easier. And those statements are entirely true, and they entirely miss the point of marriage. So a new spouse will try to impose his or her way of doing things on the other, and if they succeed, there will be some measure of peace, but a peace that comes from uniformity, not from unity. A peace that compromises the power of their marriage. Very often, it's the differences that first attracted you to this person. Right? As they say, opposites attract. And yet, very often, it's those same differences that threaten to drive you crazy, especially in the early days of your marriage. So a key task in the first few years of marriage, then, is to learn to trust the differences. So your wife is so much more emotional than you are, and you think, why can't she just be rational for once? But one day you realize genuinely that you are far better off because of her emotionality. And that's the day the power flips on in your marriage. Now, much of this class will look at how we grapple with those differences in marriage, from roles to communication to sex to children. And these differences are key to every task God gives the married couple. And they are key to the deeper purpose underlying those tasks. They are key to perceiving and portraying the goodness of God. Okay. Any questions or comments on that, the power of marriage in the differences? Josh?
One thing with that third point, you learn to trust the differences between you is, I'll say it, that's a lot easier to do when you trust in God's sovereignty. Because it's easy when you look at the differences, if you don't have God's sovereignty in mind, it's like it's easy to look at those things as problems. Mm-hmm. Instead of, hey, God purposed this. Mm-hmm. If he purposed these differences, there's a good reason for them to exist. Mm-hmm. He's the one that we trust in. Mm-hmm.
It helps a whole lot to realize that as annoying as it can be when they're looking at things the exact opposite way of you do, that's what helps bring balance for both, because we all have that nature of whatever our bent is, we can go to the extreme. And so if your partner is at the other extreme and you're communicating well, it brings you both toward the center.
Other comments, questions? Well, let's move on to a third one. The paradox of marriage. And here's what I mean. The whole point of marriage, Genesis 2:20, is that the man and the woman are different from each other. And yet, Genesis 2:24, they shall become one flesh. Different, yet one. That's the paradox. Therefore, a man, so verse 24, this is why a man leaves his father and mother and bonds with his wife, holds fast to his wife, and they become one flesh. But the man and his wife were naked and yet felt no shame. What a beautiful picture here. Nothing between them, not even a piece of cloth. All the power of those differences, yet perfect unity, they are one. Now, this begins with leaving, verse 24 says, right? Leaving your father and mother. And this means your spouse comes before everything, except God, right? Your parents, comes before them. Your job, your friendships, your hobbies, everything else in this life. You are shifting allegiances so that your family of origin becomes secondary to your new spouse. You form a new family. And that can be hard for both parent and child, especially parents who are controlling and demanding, or a child who has a good relationship with one or both parents, or a person who is emotionally, spiritually, or financially still dependent on his or her parents. Financial dependence on parents, emotional closeness to a mom or dad, and reliance on them for advice can work in marriage, but they can also derail the leaving process, and so need to be examined carefully. We'll talk more about this next week. But beyond leaving, Genesis 2 instructs a new husband to bond, to hold fast, the old King James, to cleave to his wife, to be one flesh together. Now, certainly this refers to sex. But when Jesus refers to this verse in Mark chapter 10, he speaks more broadly, right? The two shall become one. And so one implication of this is fidelity, right? God's intent is that husband and wife stay together. In a fast-paced consumer culture like ours, we can make commitments and break them rather quickly. But marriage is a qualitatively different type of commitment. It's a covenant, a permanent bond between two parties. For the single adult, this makes the leap into marriage scary because of its permanent nature. For the married adult, this is foundational because it means your spouse is not going anywhere. And so, no matter how hard things can get in marriage, your goal is straightforward. Work it out. And a second implication of holding fast. In marriage, there is reorientation of priorities to make the spouse primary. Again, under God. So after you get married, your posture towards the rest of life needs to change. Marriage is not just one area of life to be balanced with others. Marriage is the context in which you live all of life. You approach work, church, friendships, family, etc., as a married man and woman. Take career as one example. It is not the same to say that you approach marriage as a lawyer, teacher, architect, or whatever you do. Married people are not to balance career with marriage, but to approach career as a married person. This holding fast, this becoming one flesh, is complicated, though, because the man and the woman, again, are different from each other. But remember, that's the whole point. Their differences are the power of the marriage. And in those differences, then, how can they experience life as one flesh? So that in oneness, those differences that might otherwise drive them crazy become the power of the marriage. Well, three tools, which we'll look at in the class in the coming weeks, would be roles. We'll spend a whole section of our class on that. Communication. Spend a couple weeks on that. And sex. So when used poorly, right, each of those tools, roles, communication, and sex, each of these will drive them apart. And marriage becomes one of the loneliest places on earth. But used well, and oneness amidst difference is a significant way in which they will experience and rejoice in the goodness of God. Okay, any questions on the or comments on the paradox of marriage?
Is it sin that Peter still lived with his mother-in-law? We talk about leaving and cleaving. There's cultures that they don't literally leave.
No, I don't think so, because in that sense, the situation is more reversed. She's more financially dependent on him. And in a sense, he's probably being faithful to provide for his relatives and household.
Probably, yeah.
So I don't know if his dad had died or his mother-in-law, right? So his wife,
sure.
But no, I would see that probably as faithfulness. In that sense. Nothing wrong with taking care of an aging parent. That would not be an example, I think, of failure to leave. But honoring your parents in their older age.
Well, I think a young couple didn't have the money to leave, and they lived with one of the parents for, hopefully not permanently, but I guess the leaving, though, would be, in that sense, more metaphorical or more, you know, this is our house, this is our family, rather. And it's no longer mom and dad who I submit to. It's my husband, even to my wife, I sort of submit to all. But
yeah. And again, you know, financial dependence, reliance on them can work. Maybe especially in those early stages can be a help, but it can also derail that leaving process. So yeah. I would examine it very carefully. I would encourage most people not to do it. and to seek godly counsel and advice.
Isn't that leaving more of a reprioritization of the relationship? Because, I mean, you could, you know, we know a family where from the beginning they lived right next door to her parents, but they had the right boundaries and it worked very well. But we've also known people who physically left, but never cut the umbilical cord, and you know, and mom got talked to more often than wife got talked to, you know, kind of thing. And so, I mean, it's not necessarily all about the physical leaving.
Mm-hmm. Josh,
this is kind of a question, but we've read many biographies of missionaries who didn't balance very well, or at least seemingly didn't balance very well, ministry with marriage. And while we'll talk about that at all in here, but yeah, that could be a difficult one as well. People, they have a priority. It seems like that's one that's hard to weigh, is, okay, you have ministry on one hand, which is serving God, but at the neglect of your wife. And it seems like, especially on some older missionaries that we see where, you know, they go off for months on end in service to the Lord in neglect of their marriage relationship.
And I think that goes back to the comments of, we're not balancing ministry, career with marriage, but we're approaching all of that as a married person. And that is the context in which we approach that ministry and fulfill that ministry. I can get another church. I can't get another wife. So that always has faithful. Good pastors are first faithful husbands and faithful fathers. Now that's pastoral ministry, but whatever ministry, whether it's mission field or, you know, you're teaching Sunday school, all of that is secondary in a sense. Your primary ministry is to your spouse, to your children.
That seems like.
Go ahead,
James.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's interesting that in marriage you have that, the principle of the diversity within and unity, just like the church, you know, one, many members, one body, just like the Godhead, one God, three persons. And when you realize that God's intention was to, you know, have that principle manifested in marriage, it really, you know, speaks to just how wrong, you know, same-sex quote-unquote marriage is, because it just ruins that diversity and unity principle. Mm-hmm.
Good. Did you want to say?
Yeah, I mean, you talked about prioritizing marriage over career and all that. That's what it says in the book. When we hit reality, though, it's not. Some people would never ever do anything in their career or ministry because I got to take care of my family. And there's got to be, there's still balance somewhere. And I'm not saying I've figured it out at all, but you can still pursue ministry. You can still take your family to Indonesia. And, I mean, I could see the spouse saying, well, I mean, hopefully they're in agreement, but I could see people saying, you're not prioritizing your family because you go to work. Or you work more than most people. It's just, Yeah, when we apply it to everyone's situation, it's going to look different for everybody.
Yeah, and you should see your marriage together as a context for doing ministry.
Yeah.
That's one of the helpful things. At the back of this book, I've got resources, recommended resources. I just want to point those out. Really good books would be When Sinners Say I Do, Discovering the Power of the Gospel for Marriage. Really like that one. We'll talk about, I have it under an older title, What Did You Expect? But it's Paul Tripp's book, and now it's called Marriage. Six Gospel Commitments Every Couple Needs to Make. In This Momentary Marriage by John Piper, he has a whole chapter on marriage and mission, or marriage and ministry, and it's really helpful. I would commend it to you for thinking about how to approach mission and ministry as a married couple. So that would be a good chapter on that topic. I think it's towards the end of that book.
Matthew.
Yes.
Justin and I are going through. So Dave Harvey has a second book.
Yes,
I still do.
I still do.
It's excellent resource for those of us who are a little more seasoned in our marriages.
Good. Thank you. Yes. I've not read that one, but
it's good. It's really good.
Trust your recommendation. So. Again, with this, always read with discernment. I don't agree with everything in all these books, okay? Just there's that caveat. I'm not recommending everything that's argued in there, okay? The Piper book, there's things in there I disagree with, okay? But it's still good and helpful overall. Deeper than happiness, deeper than friendship, deeper than children, deeper than ministry is the purpose of marriage as a context to live out what it means to be made in God's image. Perceiving the goodness of his glory, portraying the glory of his goodness. In marriage, though, we don't do this on identical fashion because the power of a marriage is in how man and woman complement each other. So the great task of at least the early days of marriage, the great paradox of marriage, is how to bridge from Genesis 2, verse 20 to 2, verse 24, to treasure the differences and be one flesh. A marriage isn't necessarily always built at a steady pace, day by day. Instead, it's often built through a series of defining moments. A betrayal here, an honest confession there, the realization that he really does know me, a failed chance at forgiveness, the discovery that you're not as exciting as you used to be, and she's okay with that, a devastating loss, a health crisis, a mountaintop of shared joy, having a child, launching a child. Sometimes these moments come packed together. Sometimes they're months apart, but very often it's how you respond to these moments of decision that makes your marriage for better or for worse. And those responses will flow from what you want from your marriage. Do you want a bosom friend, a BFF? Do you want a happy family? Do you want the look of a happy family? Do you want security? Or deeper and more fundamentally than any of that, do you want God? And so Jesus' words in Matthew 6:33 are still pertinent to our study. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be provided for you. And that is the path to marriage as God intended. Let's close in prayer.